loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we'll talk about the two-day U.S.-organized Middle East so-called peace conference that's a gathering to put pressure on Iran. Next, the Senate Intelligence Committee has found no collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Then, Congress is finally set to help veterans who were exposed to highly toxic burn pits in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And finally, British Prime Minister Theresa May's top Brexit negotiator was reportedly overheard saying that if Parliament does not vote to support May's Brexit deal with the European Union, the Prime Minister could indefinitely delay leaving the Union. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. The deal that congressional negotiators have come up with to fund the government and avoid another shutdown is being drafted by staff members, and there is some debate about key pieces of the legislation. Democratic aides claim that the bill will bring the number of beds for detention from the current 49,000 back to Obama-era levels of 35,000 beds. But the summary of the bill, as drafted by Senate Republican staffers, shows funding for more than 45,000 beds, and internal communications show funding adjustments that could allow for over 58,000 beds. In addition, the deal allows for $1,375,000,000 for new border fencing. Senate Republicans voted for rule changes today that will speed up the process of confirming nominees to government posts. Republicans accused congressional Democrats of obstructing the Trump administration's nominees. Under the new rule, debate on nominees would be limited to 2 hours, down from the current limit of 30 hours. Ahead of Nigeria's election this weekend, the Boko Haram terrorist group launched an apparent assassination attempt against a senior government official. A convoy transporting the governor of the northeastern state of Borno, a stronghold for Boko Haram, was targeted in a suicide attack. At least 3 people were killed. Huge protests are continuing in Haiti against corruption and the government of President Jovenel Moïse. During yesterday's marches, police repression led to 7 deaths and many others were injured. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the anti-Iran conference in Warsaw. 60 countries are participating in a 2-day U.S.-organized Middle East so-called peace conference in Warsaw that starts today, and it was originally billed by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo as a gathering to put pressure on Iran. The conference comes as some countries, including several in the European Union, are hoping to salvage the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, increasing tensions with Washington. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. Welcome back, Mark.
Thanks for having me on. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Well, thank you, Mark. Let me ask you right off the bat. This conference, 60 countries participating, some of them had to be pulled by the neck in order to participate. It was originally supposed to be a Middle East peace conference. The Palestinians are supposed to be there. Netanyahu is arriving today. A whole bunch of Gulf Arab monarchs. And then it turned into an anti-Iran conference where the U.S. is trying to manhandle its friends and allies into withdrawing from the JCPOA and further isolating Iran. So what exactly is the point of this thing, and what does the United States hope comes out of it?
Yeah, actually, it's the other way around. It was originally billed as an anti-Iran conference by Pompeo. And then when there was a lot of disgruntlement coming, particularly from Western Europe, then they tried to paper over that by claiming it was a conference on Middle East peace and security in Warsaw, Poland, because Poland is such a crucial player in the Middle East.
It's the anchor of the Middle East. The anchor, the absolute anchor of the Middle East.
So actual purpose of this conference is still made clear by the fact that the U.S. Iran Action Group, which is basically their regime change group, is still in charge of coordinating the conference. And the topics that at least the U.S. wants to talk about, terrorism and extremism, missile development and proliferation, maritime trade and security, and the use of proxy forces, it reads like a list of Washington gripes against the government in Iran. So it's pretty much clear. Rudy Giuliani, who obviously has a lot of links to the Trump administration, just a day ago, he was in Warsaw ahead of it, speaking to the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the cult anti-Iranian group that the U.S. is supporting in Albania. They're not official attendees of the conference. That would paint it a little bit too much. But really, Giuliani speaking to them promised that within a few years, the Iran will be free. Well, meaning that the government in Tehran will be overthrown. So it's still pretty much clear what's going on. But they really did have to rope a lot of countries into participating. And that's 60 countries participating, some of them at an extremely low level. Evidently, Germany is sending a civil servant, and France is sending a junior deputy foreign minister.
In fact, the European Union is not sending anybody at all.
Yeah, well, Federica Mogherini, at least, is not attending. She's declining. She's the EU's foreign policy chief, as it were. But this is supposed to be billed, you know, now as a Middle East Peace and Security Conference. Of course, Iran is not there. They were denied permission to attend even after the rebilling. Lebanon is not attending. Turkey is not attending. Syria is not attending. Qatar is not attending. Palestine is boycotting it. Russia is not participating. And I could not find whether Iraq is actually sending anyone or not, but if they are, it's certainly no one of any stature. And so basically it turns out to be the U.S., its European allies represented at different levels. Obviously, Poland is pushing really, really hard to kiss the Trump administration's butt, hoping that this will signal his approval of the Fort Trump. They want U.S. military forces stationed in Poland. They've even offered to pay for it, pay for U.S. troops there, and a few other Eastern European countries. And the U.S.'s Gulf Cooperation Council allies, the Gulf monarchies, led by Saudi Arabia, obviously absent Qatar at this point.
I'd like to pursue where Poland is going on all of this. That's interesting. I mean, we have a very conservative, nationalist Polish government. On the other hand, and it's not on the other hand, but in that context, Poland is also worried, apparently, about its relations with Iran. You had Poland's deputy foreign minister travel to Iran to reassure the government in Tehran this week, you know, that Poland doesn't mean harm to Iran. Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, tweeted that his country had welcomed over, quote, 100,000 Polish refugees during the Second World War. The Polish government can't wash the shame while Iran saved Poles in the Second World War. It now holds a desperate anti-Iran circus. Does this backfire on Poland? And just characterize the Polish government's international position thus as a consequence of hosting this conference.
Yeah, obviously Poland and Iran do not have significant trade or other relations. Iran has canceled a Polish film festival to be held in Iran. Unfortunately, that's about all the consequences that Poland can expect of this. But their reassurances to Iran as they're hosting, you know, what this conference obviously is intended to be by the United States shows how genuine, how sincere their efforts to reassure Iran that they're not. But Poland is obviously in this simply acting as a U.S. client state to what is increasingly a neocon regime bent on regime change in multiple countries, and Iran is only one of them. And Poland's primary interest in all of this is simply to make the United States happy. And again, they've outright said it. Their primary concern at interest of all of this is still focused at Russia, the fear that they have that they're going to be invaded by Russia in any day now, and they believe the Trump administration is their chance to get U.S. troops permanently stationed on Polish territory, and that is their whole drive in this. I have no doubt that they would be fully behind a U.S.-Saudi Israeli regime change effort targeting Iran, but this is creating more of a split in the EU because these Eastern European right-wing governments are really splitting with, you know, the Western European, you know, controlling countries of the EU, in particular France and Germany. And this is also seen as an interference in the EU's broader domestic politics, as it were, with a right-wing populist government in the U.S. allying with a right-wing populist government in Poland and others in Eastern Europe that is exacerbating a divide in EU unity on foreign policy with regards to Iran.
Mark, we have about a minute and a half left. I want to ask you real quickly, is there any country that's attending this conference that thinks this is a conference relative to the Arab-Israeli peace talks? There was a piece in the Washington Post today saying that, yeah, this is a peace conference, but the Palestinians are boycotting and the Americans are hoping that their Gulf monarch allies can just pressure the Palestinians. That seemed to me to be disingenuous. But do you think that anybody thinks this is really a peace conference?
Well, I mean, it's peace on the U.S. Israeli idea of a peace conference, meaning that increasingly the U.S. and Israel just dictate terms to what, you know, is left of the Palestinian state at this point, which isn't much, you know, Gaza and the West Bank and continue facing continual slow ethnic cleansing. But the fact that even the usually U.S. servile Palestinian Authority in the West Bank is boycotting this and refusing to participate because of Trump recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. You know, I don't think anyone, perhaps other than the U.S. and Israel, takes that such a suggestion seriously.
That was the voice of Mark Sloboda, who joined us from Moscow. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Richard Shelby made the rounds of political talk shows over the past 2 days to say that his committee had found no collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. CBS and NBC reported at length on that conclusion. Ranking Democrat Mark Warner, however, said that he, quote, respectfully disagreed, unquote, with Shelby, adding that while there was no evidence of collusion, the committee still had to interview several key witnesses. Meanwhile, some proponents of the Russiagate campaign are attempting to downplay expectations by arguing that the Mueller probe is not expansive enough. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, this really appears to be posturing, political posturing. If the evidence isn't there, you just ignore the evidence or the lack of evidence and just keep repeating your own conclusion and hope that the American people believe it. It's also called gaslighting. And that appears to be what we're seeing now. Richard Shelby, who is no Russia dove, let me tell you, has concluded, based on his committee's investigation, that there is no evidence of collusion between the campaign and the Russian government, and the Democrats are having none of it. The corporate media is also having none of it. On NBC, just in the last couple of days, you have Ken Delanian, who's the NBC national security correspondent, saying there appears to be no evidence of collusion between the campaign and Russia. And then Rachel Maddow saying exactly the opposite, ignoring that Ken Delanian report and just saying it's there, it's collusion. She keeps throwing out the word oligarch and connections and close to Putin, whatever that means. What are we seeing unfold here?
You know, I don't think it's posturing. I think it's more serious. I think it's a case of deep psychological denial. I mean, the Democrats have invested so much in this Russiagate conspiracy story that it's been crumbling for months. But now that it seems to be reaching the last stages, the Democrats are you know, kind of curling up into a ball, a fetal ball, and refusing to face reality. Their politics of the last 2.5 years have rested on this conspiracy tale, and it's now just turning to dust.
Here's the NBC News report from February 12th. Ken Delanian, after 2 years and 200 interviews, the Senate Intelligence Committee is approaching the end of its investigation into the 2016 election, having uncovered no direct evidence of a conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia, according to both Democrats and Republicans on the committee. Okay. That's okay. After 2 years, hundreds of interviews, tens of millions of dollars have probably been allocated. The media has dominated this narrative. It's accepted as an article of faith. that there was collusion, that the reason we have Donald J. Trump as president, as odious as that is not our fault. It's the fault of the Russians and their manipulation. And now, after all of this, it turns out, guess what? There's no connection. But then even with the way the NBC News is spinning this is really important. The top headline was, Senate has uncovered no direct evidence of conspiracy between Trump campaign and Russia. Okay, that's straightforward. Subtitle, quote, we were never going to find a contract signed in blood saying, hey, Vlad, we're going to collude, close quote, one Democrat aide said. So that's the spin.
Total cop out.
Of course we couldn't find anything because we never expected to find something written in blood.
Right.
From Vladimir Putin and Trump. But the implication is that while it wasn't written in blood and thus obvious, it actually did happen. But what the senators are saying from both parties is actually it didn't happen. It's not just that we didn't expect to find a contract signed in blood. There is no evidence of collusion. And if there was the smallest evidence of collusion, that would be the story. But in fact, that's not the story.
Well, it's the whole thing is just a weird psychotic episode. And it's a sign of a deep breakdown in American politics. I mean, essentially, the entire mainstream media was caught up in a giant conspiracy tale, which in its own way was as outlandish as anything that the JFK buffs ever came up with, or the theories about Mossad, causing 9/11. It's just bonkers, but the entire media, the entire press, the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, et cetera, bought into this whole thing completely and totally. And they ignored all the other, more interesting aspects of this whole episode, such as, what was the role of the intelligence investigation agencies? What were they up to in spreading these tales? What was their real agenda?
Okay, well, let's talk about that. What is their real agenda? Because there's two elements of this. The origin of it could be the Democrats trying to find some way to explain the inexplicable, which is that they lost in the 2016 campaign to the most unpopular politician ever. That would be Donald Trump. There could be the origin or genesis of it. But it's not just the Democrats. It's the Democrats and the Republicans. And even if there's no evidence of collusion, I believe that if you go out and talk to huge numbers of people in the United States, there will be a basic agreement that there was collusion that won't change. We have a situation now of extreme animus towards Russia. That's not going to change either. That's not going to change.
No, I think there was collusion. The collusion was between the Democrats, the press, and the intelligence agencies, which were essentially trying to fight off any change in foreign policy, especially with regard to two very important countries, Russia and Syria. I mean, Trump came into office. Essentially, he was representing the greatest challenge to U.S. foreign policy orthodoxy in decades. He wanted a rapprochement with Russia, and he believed that a U.S. intervention in Syria was non-productive, counterproductive, in fact. So Trump wanted a break with U.S. orthodoxy in these two areas, and that threw the entire foreign policy establishment into a panic. And the only way they could explain it, despite their manifest failures, was that somehow Russia was making Trump say this. It's just bonkers.
It is bonkers. And, another thing, too, is, well, this morning on Morning Joe, a show that I watch because I like to criticize it as I'm watching it, they discussed the NBC report, the Ken Delanian report, saying that there was no collusion or no evidence of collusion. And then they showed several clips of Paul Manafort denying any connection between the campaign and the Russian government. It was those denials that they said proved that there was collusion, because if there hadn't been collusion, he wouldn't have felt compelled to deny that there was.
That makes perfect sense, of course, but
you can't win.
Right now, we're in a new
yes.
part of the story, which
That's
is how
right.
the media is handling the new news. That there's nothing there. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, I just think they're just like pulling the bedclothes over their head and refusing to face reality. They just, you know, and they can't admit that not only did their campaign, you know, fail in 2016, but their foreign policy failed too.
Yeah.
I mean, U.S. foreign policy in the Ukraine and the Middle East has been a disaster, a complete disaster. The U.S. is grossly overextended. Its strategy is just deeply flawed. And Trump, you know, for all his craziness, you know, at least had the sense to point up these, you know, these huge shortcomings. And the establishment would never forgive him for that. And they, as I said before, their only explanation they could possibly come up with was that somehow Putin, you know, made him do it. I see a tremendous resemblance between this whole Putin conspiracy tale and the protocols of the Elders of Zion that was very popular back in the late 19th century, which is that the liberals imagine that Putin sort of commands this vast occult worldwide, you know, conspiracy, in which he just like has to sort of wiggle his figures for all kinds of like, you know, wars to break out, presidential candidates to do his bidding, et cetera, et cetera. He's an occult master in their eyes. And it's a very strange kind of recurrence, you know, a return to these old conspiratorial models. It shows that in times of stress, people tend to resort to these old tropes, these old conspiracy tales.
Daniel, we have 45 seconds left. Now that it's coming out, there's no there, that after all of this money and time and focus, there's no evidence of collusion. Does the Russia hysteria start to lift, or is it here to stay?
Yeah, especially among Democrats.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's here to stay. I think that the Democrats have succeeded in essentially ratcheting up tensions between the U.S. and Russia. Those tensions seem to be sort of self-propelling. The U.S. and Russia are on a collision course, and I think if the Democrats win in 2020, we'll see significant danger of some kind of outright collision. I don't know what it'll be. I'm afraid to even sort of think of what it will be, but I think that possibility looms larger and larger.
We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Congress is finally set to help veterans who were exposed to highly toxic burn pits in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. Solid waste, that's everything from abandoned military equipment to plastic to expired food to body parts, is doused with jet fuel and set ablaze by the U.S. military overseas. But the smoke and fumes are highly toxic and can cause rare brain cancers. We're joined from Chicago by Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and Joe Hickman. He's a journalist, professor, and author of The Burn Pits, The Poisoning of America's Soldiers. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Joe, let's start with you. How did the military begin using these burn pits, and knowing how toxic they are, why do they continue to use them?
Well, they started using them right at the get-go from the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. They used them much earlier. They even used them in Vietnam. But what happened, I'll cover that in a second, but what happens, and most people don't realize, is how much trash war creates and how big of a problem it is for the commanders on the ground. Anything from the rubble, from the bombardments, from the soldier on the ground, which averages around 9 pounds of trash a day. So when you have thousands of troops on the ground, trash starts to build up very fast, and the commanders have to figure out what to do with it. So they decided to create open-air burn pits where they throw all this stuff in a makeshift dump and light it on fire and burn it. And the problem with that is they burned everything and anything and everything in these burn pits. They burned, as you were saying earlier, tires, wood that was treated, plastics, styrofoam, medical waste, human body parts, anything that could be burned, they burned in these burn pits. And the soldiers, in a lot of incidents on this, were stationed, their housing quarters were within 300 meters from these massive burn pits. And when I say massive, I mean that some of these burn pits, like Camp Taji, for example, burned 50 tons of trash a day for 7-8 years. And Balad even burned more than that. So there was, these burn pits were massive in over 270 locations at military bases we had in Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's the voice of Joe Hickman. Joe is a journalist, professor. He's the author of the book, The Burn Pits, The Poisoning of American Soldiers. We're also joined from Chicago by Kathy Kelly. Kathy is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Kathy, they are truly a disgusting sounding. And of course, they are and have been poisoning U.S. military personnel. And those U.S. military personnel have not had justice. But these burn pits are also in countries where the indigenous inhabitants, meaning the people who are from those countries, they don't go home. They're already home. And this is what's happening to their home. Let's talk about that side of the story.
Well, certainly Joe's statistics and descriptions are alarming. But as you say, people are already in their homes and already affected by the displacement and the trauma of war. So, for instance, immediately across from one of the largest U.S. bases in Kabul, Afghanistan, is a sprawling refugee camp. And in the refugee camp, people have been displaced now not only by war, but often by war, by drought, by combinations of circumstances. And so they come to these camps and they have no income. There are not jobs. There's already 30% unemployment in Afghanistan. And so people displaced as they are already saddled by horrible air because of multiple causes of pollution, including what Joe is describing in the burn pits in Afghanistan, they then can't possibly afford to buy wood, which would be at least a little bit better environmentally. They've got to find some source for warmth and to boil the water because the water is so poisoned. And so they start to burn tires, burn plastic bags, burn whatever substance they can find that is either cheaper or can be accumulated without any charge, and the air gets worse and worse and worse. It's so bad now that just about everybody I knew, I just got back from Kabul 2 days ago, was wearing a mask, and people are investing in masks that they hope can make them a little bit safer. But surely we must recognize the effect of war on global warming and climate change, and on by many different measures. War making is the most disastrous effect and makes it more difficult to try to turn things around.
That's Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Joe Hickman is also joining us. He's a journalist, author, professor. He's the author of the book, The Burn Pits, The Poisoning of America's Soldiers. Joe, I just ask you to respond to Kathy's comments.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's horrible. I did a chapter in my book about specifically in Kabul and in some areas in Iraq. In Kabul, cancer rates are up 20 times higher than they were before we went to war there. They are seeing birth defects now in Kabul that are so hideous they don't even have names for them. They're brand new types of birth defects in children being born. All of this, it just, when you put two and two in together, it just seems to all relate to each other. In Iraq, cancer rates are up over 100% outside of Taji and Balad in those villages and towns. So it has to be from the effects of war. A lot of people will blame it on depleted uranium, which I'm sure has something to do with. But what's been really overlooked is, for a long time, is the fact that we had these open-air burn pits, and it was just kept so quiet for so long, and then finally we were able to break this story.
Yeah, it really is quiet. You know, Kathy, you went back and forth to Iraq many times in the 1990s, bringing food or bringing medicine and exposing the impact, the humanitarian impact that economic sanctions were having on the Iraqi people. You and I actually went together at least on one trip in May 1998. I went numerous other times. The last time I was in Iraq was right before the start of the 2003 invasion, and I was in Basra in the south, and I was at a hospital, and the doctors came together, and they were showing pictures of all of these birth anomalies, birth defects. And again, as Joe mentioned, birth defects that were unlike any other birth defects that they had experienced or treated in the past. I mean, these were gruesome abnormalities. And at the time, the doctors thought this was depleted uranium, because that was kind of the main thought. This depleted uranium, it's not going anywhere. The Pentagon really didn't do any true studies to demonstrate its safety. But when I talked about it, when I came back and talked about it on the media, people here in the media were challenging me and say, oh, that's just Saddam Hussein propaganda. You're either a witting or unwitting stooge of Saddam's propaganda. And I would make arguments with them. I would say, no, these were healthcare professionals. They weren't political people. Anyway, it's something that about the war and wars that people don't know here, or they dismiss or they treat as enemy propaganda. You've been so many places in Iraq and in Afghanistan. How do you respond to them?
One story that comes to mind, Brian, is that at about that same time period you were mentioning when you were in Basra, and Iraq was a broken country by then because of the extremely cruel economic sanctions. I remember going to a gynecology hospital in Baghdad and, you know, seeing in their bedsides, children who were deformed. And I asked the gynecologist and the obstetrician, they were both women, if there was any way that they could help us, you know, learn more about the whereabouts of the parents when the child was conceived. You know, just some ways to try to connect dots. And finally, I think it was the gynecologist, a woman, a very well-trained doctor. I think she had a lump in her throat. She said, Kathy, just let me show you something. And she took me to a bedside of a child, and there was an IV pole, and the prescription for the child's medicine was written on the back of a candy wrapper with a pencil. And she said, don't you see, we don't even have pen and paper anymore. And so we had so beaten down the country of Iraq, always ostensibly because they weren't controlling the dictator who controlled them, that we could just presume, well, they certainly aren't going to be able to research the abuses that have been heaped on them, because they can't even get a pen and paper. So I think the United States has successfully broken both Iraq and Afghanistan. And when these countries are broken like this, then it also means that people can't work together to tackle and to solve their problems, because the divisions between people become exacerbated and hatreds and antagonisms are fomented and fostered. We've seen this in Iraq, and I think, you know, we're going to see it in Afghanistan as well. And so exactly what you need to be able to reverse the problems, both with regard to global warming and with regard to environmental degradation caused by war, is going to be even more difficult to accomplish because the countries are breaking apart.
That's the voice of Kathy Kelly. Kathy is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. We're also joined by Joe Hickman, journalist, professor, and author of The Burn Pits, The Poisoning of American Soldiers. When we come back after a short break, we're going to continue this discussion about what Congress says it might do finally for U.S. military personnel. And we're going to talk about the impact again on people living in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Congress is finally set to help veterans who are exposed to highly toxic burn pits in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. Solid waste, everything from abandoned military equipment to plastic to expired food to body parts, is doused with jet fuel and set ablaze by the U.S. military overseas. But the smoke and fumes are highly toxic. We are joined from Chicago by Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and Joe Hickman. He is an author, professor, and the author of the book, The Burn Pits, The Poisoning of American Soldiers. Joe Hickman, let's start back with you. I'm looking at the New York Times. Congress poised to help veterans exposed to burn pits over decades of war. Then there's a picture of a gentleman named Ryan Robinson. Quote, the smell was horrendous, said Ryan Robinson, who was in Iraq from 2006 to 2007 and breathed in fumes from open-air trash fires in Iraq. Joe, why has it taken the government the military, the VA, or Congress so long to do anything about this? And what is it that's proposed now?
Well, it's taken so long is not uncommon, it seems like. I mean, we had Agent Orange. It took over 27 years for them to take action and help those veterans that were suffering from Agent Orange from the Vietnam War. Gulf War Syndrome, it took another 15 to 17 years to help those veterans. In this case, it's just like those. The government is in full denial mode. They have been since the beginning, since they started lit the burn pits. They've been saying that there was nothing unhealthy about this, which is absolutely ridiculous when you have over 210 known carcinogenics going into the air from these burn pits, and you're saying they're not hazardous is ridiculous. But they've been in full denial mode for a long time. Right now, there's over 100,000 veterans claiming they are ill from the burn pits, and they're still being ignored. And with Congress coming forward poised to do something about it, action speaks louder than words. They've been hearing this stuff for now over a decade. Let's see something happen.
Kathy Kelly, I'm going to read a little bit from that New York Times article. Now, this was about, I mentioned this former soldier, veteran, Ryan Robinson. The smell was horrendous, said Mr. Robinson. About 9 years after returning home to Indiana, where he worked as a corrections officer, he began to suffer headaches and other health problems, which doctors attributed to post-traumatic stress. After having a seizure while driving on a Christmas day last year, he was told he had glioblastoma, an aggressive brain tumor. We were talking about what's happening to the people in Iraq and in Afghanistan, but these other injuries that are now being documented by U.S. service personnel or former personnel, they include all kinds of problems, every imaginable potential problem. I want you to comment on this issue. You know, there's such a hype before war. There was that race to war in 2003, the rush to war. I think it was not because Iraq was becoming more dangerous, but because the global anti-war movement was growing. And so Bush and Rumsfeld and those guys were rushing to get it done because, of course, they could overwhelm the Iraqi army. But when you think about the fact that they're burning everything, all this garbage, it also raises the question, why would there not be any infrastructure for handling waste and garbage, especially when the U.S. keeps intervening in country after country after country? It's not like this is a new problem that just became discovered. It seems to me to be a kind of criminal negligence on top of all of the other criminal aspects of the war. And it's just assumed by the Pentagon, we don't care. We don't care about the soldiers, and we don't care about the people that we're supposedly liberating.
And the litany goes on. They don't care about demining. They say, well, they'll get to digging up the ordnance that's been littering the ground in Afghanistan as a sort of a last step in terms of what they sometimes call retrograde missions when people are pulling out of Afghanistan. They have drawn down from 100,000 troops to about 14,000 when you include special operations people and various contractors. And so, you know, the air and the ground are so badly polluted. And I think you're right. It's criminal negligence. It's recklessness. It's repetitive. And there's such a collusion between the fossil fuel complex, if you will, and the military-industrial complex. And the two continue to feed off of each other and to make sure that the United States resource is so needed for healing our own environmentally degraded part of the world, where the superfunds are very often places that have been hideously polluted by military bases. We won't have the resources that are needed to solve these problems if we keep on throwing the money at the military corporations, the fossil fuel corporations, and the possible continuation of wars. I mean, even as we speak, we don't know if we can restrain the United States from engaging in war with Venezuela, war with Iran, even though there's been one abysmally failed criminal war after another, still face this problem that the Congress is all tied up by controls of warlords, basically. So now we do see, you know, a front page article helping to at least raise empathy and compassion for those people who were affected by the burn pits, who were there with the United States military. So let's hope that the a new Congress will be able to grapple with some of these problems and start showing a different direction.
Yeah, Kathy Kelly, I couldn't agree with you more. The fact that the U.S. government officials can keep sort of cavalierly saying all options are on the table regarding Venezuela if they don't succeed in toppling the coup through the already existing means, yeah, they're preparing for military action. And again, the people who are making these decisions, they're not the ones who are going to go and kill and be killed and then or suffer from this kind of poisoning. Joe Hicks, you know, I'm looking at the table of contents of your book, and Joe Hicks is the author of The Burn Pits, The Poisoning of America's Soldiers. We're also talking to Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. I'm looking at your table of contents. I haven't read your book, but I certainly will, and I encourage our audience to get it. But one of the points that chapter number 3 is a disastrous record. That's the title of your chapter 3 of your book. What do you mean by that?
Well, what you were just speaking about, I think it's crystal clear right now that the Iraqi war was initiated over a lie. The whole thing was bogus. We should never went to Iraq. But the horrible thing is Dick Cheney, before he was vice president, he was the CEO of KBR, a military contractor, and he gave up that position to become vice president in 2000. When he left, he had $20 million in stock options with that company. So when the Iraqi war started, who got the contract to construct and operate the burn pits was KBR, and they had many other contracts in Iraq as well. By 2009, Vice President Cheney's stock options quadrupled from the war, basically. So I think it's even more sinister than when people really start really digging in deep on this. It comes down to the almighty dollar as well. And we could have obviously put in high temperature incinerators for this trash, which many British military bases did, and there was no issues there. But instead of doing that, we hire a contractor, KBR, to construct and operate these burn pits right on our military bases and right outside of these villages and cities.
Terrible. Kathy, we have 90 seconds left. I'm looking at an article in EcoWatch. U.S. military is the world's biggest polluter. It's by Whitney Webb. The first sentence, last week, mainstream media outlets gave minimal attention to the news that the U.S. Naval Station in Virginia Beach had spilled an estimated 94,000 gallons of jet fuel into a nearby waterway less than a mile from the Atlantic Ocean. When you really document what's going on in particular countries, but in the aggregate on a global basis, the Pentagon does seem to be the biggest polluter. It also seems to act with absolute impunity. 45 seconds left.
Well, I don't think we can ever have a rational discussion about how we can solve the problems we face in terms of an environment that could be, you know, at risk of the planet becoming extinct in terms of species and human beings. We can't have a rational discussion until we discuss how to dismantle the reckless and criminally negligent military.
That's the voice of Kathy Kelly. We were joined from Chicago by Kathy. Kathy is a longtime peace activist, human rights activist. She is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Kathy, real quick, what's your website?
VCNV.org, the acronym for Voices for Creative Nonviolence.
So if people want to get involved with the organization, learn what they're doing. And we were also joined by Joe Hickman. He is a journalist, professor, and the author of The Burn Pits, The Poisoning of America's Soldiers. I haven't read the book. I will. I encourage our audience to also go get that book. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
British Prime Minister Theresa May's top Brexit negotiator is finding himself in a bit of some hot water. He was reportedly overheard speaking in a Brussels bar and saying that if Parliament does not vote to support May's Brexit deal with the European Union, the Prime Minister could indefinitely delay leaving the Union, keeping the country in economic and political limbo with no end in sight. May spoke before Parliament today to address the controversy. We're joined from London by Steve Headley. He's the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. Welcome back, Steve.
Thank you for the invite.
Steve, this is kind of a novel approach. Theresa May has been stuck between a rock and a hard place for months. This is that immovable object meets the irresistible force, and she knows that either way she doesn't have the votes in Parliament. But what happens if she just decides to indefinitely delay any action?
Well, she can't, because on the 29th of March, they're going to crash out of the European Union with a no-deal Brexit, if that's what she's going to do. And I think what she's been accused of by many people, which I think is probably her strategy, is she's going to run down the clock until we get to the verge of either her deal or a no-deal Brexit. And she's going to hope that enough people support her version of Brexit, the one that she's had on the table, because she's not going to get any meaningful changes to that Brexit deal. And she's going to hope that people are kind of blackmailed in the allowing her deal to be voted through Parliament, with the alternative being a no-deal Brexit.
The Europeans have been crystal clear that the deal is the deal, and they're not going to go back and renegotiate, even though she has paid lip service to the right wing of the Tory party, saying that she does support some sort of renegotiation. If there is no renegotiation, then there likely won't be, and it goes to vote on March the 29th. What happens with this?
That's what I'm wondering. Yeah. Can there just be an indefinite delay? Would the EU tolerate it? And thus Britain stays in the EU vis-a-vis...
Basically. And it doesn't address the hard border, soft border issue either.
No, what would happen is that I think that there were a number of amendments being tabled in Parliament where Parliament would basically take control from the government, which it can do if it's the backing's there. I don't think people are going to accept a continual delay at Brexit. I think they would have to revoke Article 50 to do that. What they may go for is a few months delay. I think that's the very, very most that people would countenance. I mean, half our own party would not countenance any more than a couple of months delay. But I think that we really are in uncharted waters now, because I think May's backing or banking on several Labour MPs who she's blatantly trying to bribe with promises of more money for their particular constituencies. Most of them are in the north of England. Most of them voted for Brexit. She's trying to bribe them to vote through her particular deal on Brexit. So that's her strategy. She wants to scare most of the Tory rebels and be voting for her deal on the fact that there's going to be a no-deal Brexit, and bribe a load of Labour MPs by promising them money for their own particular constituencies if they back her deal for a Brexit. So I think that's May's strategy, but I think it's unlikely to succeed.
Well, see, that's something that people in the press really aren't talking about, is maybe this is May's strategy. Maybe May wanted him to speak loudly in a bar in Brussels and have this issue debated in the press, just to help to mold public opinion in advance of the end of March.
Well, I think that if that's the game, it's a very, very dangerous one. I think that the ERG, led by Jacob Rees-Mogg, I think, are a considerable part of the Tory party, and people around them will not countenance any kind of deal that prolongs or seeks to prolong Brexit indefinitely. At the very, very most, these people are talking about a month or two extension, which is the period needed to negotiate a Brexit deal. They will not put up with any shenanigans that extends it beyond that. And if that's what May is planning to do, that's a really high-risk strategy.
So let's assume that this thing is just going to continue coming to a head. There's not going to be an indefinite delay, and there has to be either a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit. How does this resolve itself in the end?
Well, that's a million-dollar question, because there doesn't seem to be a majority in Parliament for anything just at the minute. So I have to say, at the present time, it's looking like a no-deal Brexit. That's how it's looking now, just now, because unless there's a massive sea change within the Conservative Party, then May's deal is not going to get voted through. There's not really a possibility of indefinite extensions to the withdrawal agreements. The only alternative to that is a no-deal Brexit.
What happens to Ireland? What happens to the backstop?
whoa, I mean, this is where it gets real, because we have a position at the minute where there is a border between the north and south of Ireland. They occupied six counties in the north, which are under British rule, and the rest of Ireland, which is independent. And it suited people from the so-called Republican tradition and the Unionist tradition to pretend that that border hasn't been in place. The reality is there is a border in place. And if there is a no-deal Brexit, that border will have to be enforced.
Certainly part of the end of the war in Ireland, was
the border.
Was making that border soft so that because of the, I mean, let's just think through what this would actually mean. The Sinn Féin, the Republican wing of the population inside Northern Ireland, if there's a hard border, if, in other words, the going back and forth to the other part of the island of Ireland becomes like a traversing an international border, it would seem to me that the likelihood, I don't know if it's likely, I don't really have knowledge enough to know that, but it certainly provides the kindling for the end of the agreement that brought that war, the war in Ireland, to a close.
Well, yeah, it would tear up the Good Friday Agreement, which is absolutely correct. If a border was to be enforced even by electronic means, I mean, the scenario was likely to run like this. They put up cameras on the border. The cameras will get attacked or get knocked down. They'll put in security staff to look after the cameras. The security staff will be told that if they don't disappear, they're likely to get damaged in some way. They'll then send in the security forces to protect the security staff, and then the security forces will become targets. So that is the likely scenario. I think most people think that that is a scenario that is likely to unfold. So we have the prospect of the main group, which were Republicans, represented by Sinn Féin and the Provisional IRA, being forced into either abandoning the ceasefire or abandoning any pretense to be Republicans.
You know, I think this is such a critical point, and it's something that I think most Americans don't understand. This isn't just an issue of being in the European Union or not being in the European Union. There's a possibility, a real possibility, that people could die because of this decision.
And Steve, nobody, I mean, when you think back, the referendum was June 2016. Would it have been in the minds of those who proposed this Brexit referendum from the Tories that this could be the possible outcome? I mean, it would seem to me that no one was thinking about this.
Well, I mean, I think it's an open secret that David Cameron, who was the Conservative leader and indeed the Prime Minister at the time, thought that any Brexit referendum would deliver a vote to stay within the European Union. And I doubt very much if anybody gave much thought to the north of Ireland and what effects it would have on the border if the vote came back as a yes, because they didn't think that the vote was going to come back as a yes anyway. And I really think that the vast majority of people who voted in that referendum, it wasn't a consideration. Funnily enough, in the north of Ireland, there was a majority to stay within the European Union. And the constituents of the north of Ireland, most of them are unionists. It's about 55% unionists, 45% nationalists. So you must have had considerable numbers of unionists voting to remain within the European Union in the north of Ireland.
Yeah, it just shows how the whole concept, in terms of the basic elements of democracy, the people in Ireland, on both sides of the divide, voting one way, and here you have these decisions that are about to be taken that could like throw them and the island of Ireland into a new level of chaos. And John, as you said, people may well die. I mean, we don't have to be hyperbolic, but the stakes here are pretty loaded. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal article that just came out 1 hour ago, Stephen. Shockingly, the headline is that as Brexit deadline nears, EU loses confidence in May. I mean, I wondered if this was an Onion headline because the irony of it is such. Anyway, why don't you help us take us out with that? 30 seconds to go.
Well, I actually feel sorry in a way for Theresa May. It's sympathy with the devil. I don't like the woman. I don't like her policies. But I think she's now being used as some sort of flunky who's running, who's been sent over to the European Union, and they know that she's going to come back with an answer that the European Union aren't going to change whatsoever. The European Union think the British government are absolutely crazy. They think that they've it created a catastrophic scenario for Britain. And you can't believe that May has negotiated a deal and then agreed the deal with the European Union is now trying to change parts of that deal. I mean, it's just not going to happen. The vision that the European Union has of Britain and its politicians is very poor one at the minute.
That was the voice of Steve Headley, who joined us from London. Steve's the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.